Welcome to some of our newbies. Good to see you. Hope we'll get a chance to meet you. A lot of dancing going on tonight. So everyone get ready. Okay, show us some of your moves that you haven't been able to show us this year. So a little bit dancing tonight. So.
What? I would love to see some similar moves.
Okay, I'll bust some moves for you. But seriously, the Gemara says we'll start with source number two. When you go up to Shemayim, so these are the questions that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will ask everyone. Very interesting Gemara. We don't really have a cheat sheet for the final exam in Shemayim, but this is the closest we have. These are the questions everyone faces when you get to heaven. First question, source number two. Amar Rav B'Shav Shemachnisim Adam Ladin Omrim Lo Nasasa Vinasasa or Vinatata Be'emuna. The foundation of religion is morality and honesty, integrity, menschlichkeit. First question Hashem asks here, it's not the Tosfos that you learned in Beitza, not even a Batarigan's Chug, that's an important one. First question is, were you honest, straightforward, noble, kind-hearted? Foundation. Foundation is not firmkeit, but menschlichkeit. The foundation is flimsy, then the tower will be, wobbly. So always make sure you tell the truth, honest, straightforward, caring, sensitive to people. You know, you can divide the world into two people, and there's a line between them that's as large as a canyon. Those that show respect to other people and those that disrespect other people. And you can see it in every single facet of life, in their relationships, in their marriage, the way they drive, the way they behave in public. So be on the right side of that equation. Be on the right side of people that are respectful to other people. And if you find people that are disrespectful or manipulative of other people, try and steer away from them. You're not going to have a healthy relationship with those people. Second question HaKadosh Baruch Hu will ask you. Source number two, Kavata Itim Latara. Okay, so hopefully the boys that have been here for a while have heard this from me. Boys that have just joined, welcome to your new world. Ruffle your feathers a little bit. Say it as bluntly and as frontally as I can. Every single Orthodox Jewish male has a chiyuv to study Torah. If you don't study Torah, you are not an Orthodox Jewish male. There's no qualifier for that sentence. Because orthodoxy means you accept all the 613 mitzvahs. You can't say, I'm Orthodox. I don't do nevela. I don't do basar b'chol, but I'm Orthodox. Yeah, I'm Orthodox, but shatan is not really my thing. Orthodoxy means you try to fulfill every single one of the 613 mitzvahs. Talmud Torah is one of the, I didn't say it's the, we're not into that Nevesh HaChaim thing right now. It's a mitzvah among 613. So if you decide you just don't learn Torah, you're not Orthodox. Now, many people today who are part of the Orthodox world don't learn Torah. In many, many cases, they just didn't have the background. We're facing a fissure and a break in our tradition, primarily because of the Holocaust. A lot of people didn't have education, didn't have economic facility, had to work hard. But I'm not discussing your uncle, your friend, your father's friend, you. This is the life you should be orienting yourself towards. How much Torah? Okay, that's a whole separate question. What do you have to learn? That's a whole separate question. That's where it starts to get subjective, and you learn this amount, and you learn that amount. But you can't just decide, I'm going to plan my life to be an Orthodox Jew, you know, Talmud Torah, maybe, if I get around to it. Has to become an imperative, and that's why you're here this year, to develop the skills, the orientation, the passions, that you can spend a lifetime learning Hashem's Torah and becoming the mitzvah, let alone understanding the HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Question number three. We haven't got to Yom HaTzimut yet. Question number three. Asakta b'peria v'rivia. Did you raise your family? Major difference between Western civilization and Judaism. How do you view the years between 20 and 50, 20 and 60? Once you're 50, you're already over the hill. These are your prime years. You're strong, vital, you're earning power. Western civilization, get a little something for yourself. Enjoy yourself. Get a nice car, go on a yacht, go on a cruise. Not hedonistically, not egocentrically, just Judaism. How much can you invest in the next generation? I mean, just think about your parents. How much did they invest in your family and your community? How many yachts, cars, trips, cruises? Could they have afforded if they hadn't sent you to Jewish school, hadn't afforded kosher food, hadn't made Shabbos, hadn't community shul? So we're investing in the future. It's not just having children, it's raising children. How many children should you have in your family? I'll be the first one to tell you, okay? Right here. Not gonna hold anything back. You have as many children as you possibly can. Okay, now that's a qualifier. Possibly can is a very interesting set of parameters because it depends upon economy, psychology, marriage, a lot of things. So you should have as many kids as you possibly can. That should apply to everyone in this room. The part that doesn't apply equally to everyone in this room is, how much can I? And that's a personal decision. But it shouldn't be, well, what is the average size family in Western civilization? 2.3 and a dog and a goldfish. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us that capacity to bring people into this world, introduce them into a life of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a life of productivity. You don't want to give that gift. You don't want to share that gift. Now, you don't want to share in a way that could be counterproductive. You know, you can't afford, you can't raise, it's too hard, it's too stressful. By the way, one of the great selling points of Aliyah, since it is a Yom HaSmut share, we haven't talked about Yom HaSmut yet, it's just easier to have a really big family in Israel, especially vis-a-vis America, because in America, you're paying for private tuition, and even in South Africa, and I said, here, it's built for kids. The outside is safe. Your kids can go take 10 shekel and go up north for 3-4 days from the teenagers. It's not scary. It's not intimidating. It's not like you have to be on top of them. More or less education is free. More or less health coverage is free. It's subsidized. So this is a really kid-friendly environment. So when I speak to a lot of my friends who are my age, we talk about the decisions we've made. Say, well, we just weren't able to have as large a family because the financial considerations were just more complicated, which is one of the things to think about as you're starting to process where you want to live one day. Anyway, so those are the first three questions. Fourth question, important question. Talked about morality and ethics. We talked about Talmud Torah. We talked about family life. Fourth question is source number two, Tzipis Yeshua. A Jew lives a double life. Namely, Jews aren't escapists. We aren't nihilists. We're not looking to flee from this world. We're not escapists. This is a world that we embrace, whether we live in Alon Shvut, Teaneck, Glen Hazel, Melbourne. This is your world. You embrace it, you improve it, you advance it, you repair it. But there's a bifurcation in every Jew. This is not really the place I'm supposed to be. This is not really the world I'm meant to inhabit. There's this other place that I'm part of. And that other place isn't going to in any way hypnotize me against living in my world. I'm still going to be part of a community. I'm still going to have a job. I'm still going to have a family. But I know that I belong somewhere else. And I know the world belongs somewhere else. I know that as impressive as the world is technologically, and as impressive as the world is financially, as impressive as the world is culturally, there's something else waiting for me that's superior. And I dream of it. And now for the first time in history, it's not just something you can dream about, because that's something you can do in Poland 200 years ago, or in Spain 700 years ago, or in France 900 years ago, or in Syria. Because that's all Jews could do. When they read this Gemara for hundreds of years, all they could do is, well, maybe one day that will come true. Let me just maintain my imaginative apocalyptic vision. Now it's not just maintaining that alternate vision of the way the world should be. You can actually be part of the end of history. It's an incredible prospect. History's ending. 6,000 years of history are about to end. I can't tell you how quick that about will happen, but it's happening. We're in that final, final chapter. And the decisions you make, quite frankly, can really form that final chapter of history. When I was your age, a little bit older, obviously, I made that decision. In my terminology, I gave up my career, which would have been much more successful and much more broad. I'd stayed in America, which is where I'm a natural. I gave up my career to be part of history. I said, I want to raise my kids in this country. I want to live in this country. I want to be part. I don't want to be on the sidelines of history. I want to be part of history. There's a woman named Chana Henkin, who formed or established the girls program or the girls-based medrash called Nishmat. Some of you may have friends who learned, their sisters, relatives who learned there. So unfortunately, what's it, about 5-6 years ago, her children were killed in a stabbing. Remember, there was a whole slew of knifings about 4 or 5 years ago. So her children actually weren't killed through a knife, a stabbing attack, but were killed, I think, in a drive-by shooting. So I went to be Menachem Avel, Mrs. Henkin, who I'm close with. And I was sitting in her living room, and a group of seminary girls came in with their rabbi, not knowing Mrs. Henkin. She didn't know them. They didn't know her. They were just there to pay a nichum aveilim to a notable figure who was sitting aveilim. This was a field trip for them. So it was an awkward situation. 15 high school girls walk in. It's a small apartment. So she made the best of the situation. She asked the girls, she said, girls, how many books of Tanakh are there? One of the girls raised her hand and said, 24. So she said, wrong. What do you mean, 24? Is an easy one. Chavdala Sifrei Tanakh. She says, she didn't say it like that, obviously. She said, there's another book. It's the 25th book of Tanakh. And it's about the return of the Jews to their homeland and the struggle to return to their homeland. And my children who were killed, they're in that book. They're in that 25th book.
the book that's being written as we live. One day we'll look back and we'll read the book. It may not be a book that's cobbled together through prophecy like the first 24, but it's a book that's written in blood. It's a book that's written in sacrifice. And it's a book that you all have the opportunity to be a part of. And today is the day. Today is the day. Tomorrow is the day. When you blurt out, Zeh Yom Masa Adonai Nagila V'Nisim Chavo, we're able to absorb the Nisim that occurred. In the beginning of Parshas B'Shalach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was worried about navigating along the western coast of Israel, because that's the most direct shot into Israel. Take the Jews out of Egypt, hug the coastline, enter through more or less Tel Aviv, Ashdod, and then ferry your way over to eastwardly to Jerusalem. That'd be the best way to get to Yerushalayim, rather than not the 40-year roundabout, but we're still roundabout to go through the Sinai Desert. So why does Hashem avoid that route? Because of traffic, because of the Plishtim. And the Ramban explains, because not just the Plishtim were ferocious and fearless warriors, but the Jews were slaves. You don't just segue from being a slave into a soldier. Soldiers need psych, confidence, aggressiveness, discipline. There's a shift. I see the shift in boys in this yeshiva, from sheer bet to being soldiers. I see the shift to my own children. Soldiering, fighting, is not just how skilled you are at handling weapons. It's a state of mind. It's a confidence. It's an attack mode. And you have to build that confidence. You have to build that culture. And you just can't build that culture in slaves. When you think about the Jewish people recovering after the Holocaust, 3 years in the sweep of history is a hiccup. Holocaust ends in 1945. Jewish refugees who've lost everything, seen their families executed in front of their eyes, lost everything they owned, lost all their spirit, all their confidence. They moved to Israel and they fend off invasions from all these foreign Arab legions and Arab armies. That is a nace that supersedes in some ways what happened in Mitzrayim 3,300 years ago, that we were able, these former Holocaust victims, and even in Eretz Yisrael, where they weren't victimized as much by the Holocaust, and a lot of people fought in Eretz Yisrael, they were victimized by Arab riots, that our people, sometimes, and I'll talk with you, Eretz Hashem, in a couple of weeks about the miracles of 1967. Those are really different. But the miracles of 48 are a little bit more muted. It took a two-thirds majority on November 29th, 1947, to vote for the establishment of the State of Israel. Do you know the first time that there was a two-thirds majority in the Cold War era? November 29th, 1947. You know the last time there was a two-thirds majority in the UN in the Cold War era? November 29th. You didn't get two-thirds majorities. Whatever the Eastern Bloc voted, the Western NATO voted against. Whatever Western NATO countries voted for, the Eastern Bloc led by the Soviet, there was no love. There was no amor between the Western NATO, and somehow everything aligned. Tomorrow when I say Halel, Harim Makduchi Elim Givos Kivnei Tzon, which is a metaphor. It's a metaphor about the mountains dancing like sheep because the Jewish people were coming. There are no mountains dancing like sheep. It's personification. You're personifying nature. I think about the UN, these great large mountains, and mountains are immovable, that were set against one another, the Eastern Bloc and the Western nations. They all started to dance in lockstep. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the Soviet Union dance, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes in histories in ways that obliterate the imagination, the Yamsuf, Matan Torah, Dam Barad. And then sometimes Hashem works within politics and within the UN and within, and for some reason Hashem has chosen over the last 73 years that our Geula, just like he chose in Mitzrayim, what's his whole song and dance about Paro and Makos and breaking his will and what he will decide, what he won't decide? Snap your fingers, Hashem. We all saw the Avengers. Snap your fingers and just make it work. What's this all law? And that, to a degree, Rav Mital would tell us that's what had Moshe Rabbeinu so confused at the beginning of Shemos. And for some reason, because history is meant to be redeemed by the Jewish experience, Hashem likes to work through history sometimes. And sometimes, you know, Koresh requisitioned the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. And I'm sure to the contemporary Persian, it seemed like, well, he's got his reasons in politics and economics. And but looking back, was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Mashiach, as Yeshayah himself calls him in Simim Nam Dalet. So just try to absorb the fact that you're living through this era, the giddiness, the euphoria to live through this era. And again, you're not living through the era. You didn't live through the war, but 70 years, sweep of time, 70 years is nothing. And we are the generation that Hashem chose. This was a revolution to me when I came to the yeshiva, that part of my religion, part of my firmkeit, wasn't limited to how much Gemara I learned, to how well I daven, how well I perform mitzvahs, but this historical consciousness to be sensitive to who we are as a people, where we've been, what the expectations are. And that's part of my Frumkeit, and then I could look into Tanakh to be able to draw messages and lessons that make Tanakh come alive. Tanakh seems like this old yellow book of goat herdsmen, sandal wearing, canteen drinking, and all of a sudden, well, these events happened before in different eras, and we live in a technological era, but it's the same. And just living here, where our avos lived, and walking on the roads that they walked on, and living near Maris and Achpel, and living near Kever Rachel, all of a sudden my world switched from the United States and the Pentagon in the 80s, and all of a sudden my world switched to the world of Tanakh, and the world of our people, and the world of history. And this is a day to think about how you'll fulfill that challenge of history. It's not easy. That's why so many people who are successful at the classic ritual-based parts of Yiddishkeit, the Torah, the Halacha, it's hard. Halacha is rational. How big should a lulav be? How black should tefillin be? How much matzah? That's an easy one, not easy to eat. Because halacha is rational, it's quantifiable, it's organized. Geula is much more imaginative, lyrical, it's a song, it's sensitivity to Judaism, it's panoramic sweep, knowing who you are, where we've been, the struggle to come back to our land. You have to have a little imagination, you have to have a heart, you have to love Jews, love Jew. It's a very different experience. Chizki HaMelech could have been Mashiach, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, because we have to read some sources. Vigash HaKadosh Baruch Hu lasas Chizki HaMashiach. Why wasn't he? Where it says, because he woke up on the second day of Pesach. It happened on Pesach. Remember, Pesach is called Leil Shemurim because there are a lot of miracles that happen on the night of Pesach. And then Mirtz Hashem, part of Mashiach, I can't tell you what part of Mashiach, but part of Mashiach will happen on Pesach. Remember that first Seder, for those who had two Starim, the Seder, for those who had one Seder. At the end of the Seder, after everything, we say a piyut. Does anyone know what the piyut is called? Vayihi? Bachatzi halayla. And it lists all the miracles that happened dating back to the days of Avram all the way through Tanakh, including Purim. Purim unfolds over Pesach. So this is a Leil Shemurim. It's like a table. You reserve a table in the restaurant. This is a date that's reserved for miracles. It's a date that's reserved for supernaturalism. So Sancheriv is besieged. There are 165, 185, I forget right now, by Tanakh, but quite a few soldiers encircling Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is doomed. Wakes up the next day, and they've all been slaughtered. He's just looking at this graveyard of dead Assyrian soldiers. That's it. Yerushalayim is saved. And this could be Mashiach. History could end right there. Could you imagine if history ends right there? There would be no MTA program. You'd all be Israeli. You'd be no overseas. You'd all be Israeli. We all live here. Why didn't he become Mashiach? Why didn't history end? Well, there are a lot of junctures that history could have ended, but it didn't, because of the Egel, because of the Meraglim, because of the betrayal. There's a lot of moments in time, and if you read Shir HaShirim, it's about lost opportunities and about failure to respond to Hashem's solicitation. But this is a little bit more subtle. Why wasn't he Mashiach? Chizkia, line number 3, Shasisalo kol anisim halalo v'lo amar shira. He didn't respond by thanking Hashem. The ability to respond to redemption by singing Hashem's praise and becoming excited by it and realizing it, and it's obviously not easy. Chizkia wasn't able to, and others aren't able to. Shira chadasha shibchu geula, but if you're a gaol, your shir has to be renewed. Now, why was Chizkia unable to recite shira? Well, that's a pretty big mystery. The Gemara doesn't say. But I'll tell you one reason. A reason that's really relevant for 221. Not only 221, but for the modern era. You see, I just told you the end of the story, the final chapter in Chizkiah's conquest of Sancheriv Melech Ashur. But what happens prior to that, in the previous prakim? Come on, what happens, Tanakh people? Sancheriv tears through the north of Israel, exiling all the 10 tribes, obliterating the cities. The entire north of Israel is in tatters. The entire north of Israel is smoldering. Sancheriv literally eviscerates it. And then he comes to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is miraculously saved. So Chizkiah wakes up and says, well, this can't be Mashiach. This can't be redemption because it's imperfect. Because if this were redemption, Sancheriv wouldn't have captured all the northern kingdom. It would have been complete. It would have been absolute. It would have been immaculate. Immaculate redemption. And it's not always immaculate. And sometimes it's staged. Sometimes it happens as a process, and sometimes it's imperfect. Sound familiar? A lot of people feel, well, if this were a religious state, That's a whole different story. If it weren't Ben-Gurion and it weren't Moshe Dayan and it weren't, it would have been the Chafetz Chaim as the first prime minister, that would be the Yad Hashem. I can't tell you why it wasn't, because I wish it were, and I wish the state would be religious. And if you're not able to wish that, then there's something flawed about your religious Zionist, because we'd wish if you could close your eyes and our state would be firm, because you can't just be a Zionist if you're a religious Zionist, if you are. But I can't understand Hashem's redemptive patterns and redemptive policies. And instead of nitpicking them into oblivion, instead of critiquing them because they don't accommodate your expectations, Hashem expects us just to say Shira, to be happy for what He's given us and to have historical perspective. And I have so many stories because I talk about this so often, so I really don't even know where to begin to tell you the stories. But today was a bittersweet day. The bitter was obvious. Sadness, tragedy, lives that are crushed. I don't know if you had a chance to stand by graves and commiserate with people who live through this nightmare that we try to peek into today a little bit, and they live it their entire day. Their entire lives are shrouded by the darkness. But it's also a day of tremendous pride. Every time I walk by a soldier, my Zaidi told me that he was walking home in White Russia one Shabbos morning, and a drunk Russian soldier came over to him and said, "You have 20 minutes to go back to your family, collect your belongings, and report back for duty. I'm requisitioning you as my weapons bearer into World War I. So I asked my Zaidi, "What did you do?" He said, "Meshala." So he called me Meshala because he was a Litvak. My name is Moshe. Meshala. He took my hand in his hand. What could I do? He would have hunted down my whole family. He gave me 20 minutes. If I don't come back, he's going to hunt me down and massacre the entire family. Of course, I had to run back. So I ran back and I joined World War I. And as we all know, the Russian army wasn't known for its efficiency. Every time they retreated, everyone deserted. So it wasn't a long service. But I lived my entire youth haunted by that story. Then my Zaidi lived in abject terror of drunk Russian soldiers. But it wasn't just my Zaidi. Do you know what Jews felt when soldiers or policemen came to town? Terror. Dread. Because you could be maimed, murdered, raped, pillaged, robbed with impunity. Because no one really cared about the Jews. Very rarely. I can show you Haggadahs throughout the centuries. Kineged Arba Badim Dibra Torah, the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam, the Shena De'Elishol. Haggadahs that have illustrations next to the children. As most Haggadahs do. The Chacham, a wise person, a firm person. What are the illustrations next to the Rasha in many, many Haggadahs? Russian soldiers, Polish Cossacks, Spanish soldiers, Roman soldiers, Greek soldiers, Arabian Nights, whatever it is. Because Jews were at their mercy. Jews were at their mercy. About 2 years after I made Aliyah, I'm driving home through Beit Lechem. There's no bypass road. I'm driving home from Yerushalayim with Hanukkah night. And a policewoman pulls me over for speeding, a Jewish policewoman. She issues a ticket. And as she's writing the ticket, I start breaking down crying. Not because of the ticket, I'm taking that crying. I start crying, say, "Wow, what a schuss." Not such a big schuss. Like it hit me. My Zaidi lived in abject fear of drunk Russian soldiers, and here I am receiving a ticket from a policewoman on her way home to light Hanukkah candles on the Yom Tov we celebrate the restoration of Jewish sovereignty. I literally started crying. How history has changed in less than 80 years. This was 93, let's say. My Zaidi was in 1950, 1960, during World War I. Remember a couple of years ago, my family went vacationing up north in Naharia. So we were walking along the boardwalk, and I lost my phone. Okay, we looked for it in the sand. Go on, okay. As we say in Israel, kapara, kapara, whatever. So I'll be in my carpet khatas. 2 hours later, my wife gets a call from my phone, which ended up in the police station. Someone turned in your phone. You're welcome to come claim it. This was about, let's say, 5-6 years ago. This was the first time I've ever been at a police station in Israel. I don't frequent a police station. I'm not a drug dealer. I don't really hang out there. So. Surprise, right? So this is the first time I was in a police station. And I walked in there, like, hugging the policeman. It was a moment for me. A Jew who lived in fear throughout history now walks into his own police station. Our sovereign state. This is the message that Rav Amital gave us about Zionism, about our Gula. Let me articulate it for you, because it's a dual message. It's a very subtle message. On the one hand, he helped us look back into Tanakh and draw messages, paradigms, guidance, imaginative, not one-to-one. You can't say, oh, because this happened in the year X, this is going to happen in the year Y, or Koresh, I can learn it. Don't be too specific, because that's very dangerous when you start to try to predict messianic outcomes and try to associate words in Tanakh with current events. But general patterns. On the other hand, he helped us realize that when we think about Geula, our minds get ahead of ourselves. Our hearts get ahead of our minds. Our expectations spike. We think it's going to be perfect, and it's not. We think it's going to be immediate, and it's not. We think the leadership will be speckless, and it's not. And he taught us to have a realistic, balanced, and sober expectation of redemption. It doesn't have to happen all at once, which I think you take probably for granted because you've been in this yeshiva. It isn't. If you're looking for one of the major, major differences, not that the differences are so large, between a more Gush-inspired view of Geula and a more Rav Kook-inspired view of Geula, because there's so many Rav Kook Talmidim and Rav Kook yeshivas. Again, this is very, very general, but it's a general sense, at least for someone that doesn't learn or teach in that world. It seems as if, because remember, Rav Kook had these very, very inflated, augmented, immediate visions of Geula. And he assumed that all the secular Jews with whom he was forming an alliance to build the country would within a generation or two turn their hearts towards Hashem. And he had a very, very, he had a very idealized view of how the country, remember, Rav Kook didn't live through the Holocaust. And Rav Kook didn't see the state actually come into fruition as a secular state. So he didn't see those two major events. So his Zionism was pre-Holocaust, and his Zionism was always theoretical, rather than seeing an actual state dominated by not just secular Jews as we have today, but by staunchly anti-religious Jews. If you're looking for one of the major, major differences, which I'm not really sure the Haredim have fully picked up. If you're asking for one of the updates that I think would possibly change their tone, is the founders of the state were not secular. The founders of the state were anti-religious, staunchly. Atheists, socialists, Marxists, communists. There's a very, very different feel. Today, there are flanks of such, but most Jews who aren't from today, we call them Masoreti. They're traditional. They have a soft spot in their heart. They want to keep tradition. They're not anti until, of course, they're provoked by what they feel is incorrect behavior by religious people. But they have a soft spot for religion. And that's a major change in our country. And that change has, of course, been reflected by the political shift from left to right. For so many years, the left-wing parties controlled the government. And by and large, that's the culture that they produce or that they generated in this country. Those were the dual statements about Rav Amital. On the one hand, looking back to Tanakh for guidance. Is this all just some fake? Is this all some veneer, some facade? After all, maybe it's the work of the Satan. Maybe the Satan is trying to fool us all. So Rav Amital taught us the following psukim, source number 3 in Chokhtim, where Manoach and his wife, Shimshon's parents, see all these revelations and angels and sacrifices and fire coming down from heaven and the angels ascending to heaven. And Mr. Manoach is worried. He says, maybe this is all just an illusion. Maybe it's all a deception. So what does his wife tell him? Vayomer Manoach el ishto, mos namos, ki elokim reino, we're going to die. And what does his wife correct him with? Vatamer lo ishto, lu chafetz Hashem lahamiseinu. If Hashem wanted to kill us, lo lakach miyodein olo mincha, he wanted to take in our carbon, lo heranu us kol eila, he wouldn't have shown us all these miracles. I could go back into 1952 when the Satmar Rebbe wrote Vayol Moshe and engage in that theoretical conversation about whether this is real or whether this is just an illusion. But there's been a lot of change between 1952 and 2021. How many Jews lived in Israel when the state of Israel was formed? Anyone know? It's a really cool number. Approximately. 600,000. Approximately. Again, it's close enough to 600,000 to make it work. Same amount of Jews who left Mitzrayim. Okay, it's close enough, obviously. How many Jews live in Israel now? 6 million? More? No, Jews living in Israel. That's not natural population growth. And it's not a country in which you'd expect there to be a population growth. And all of a sudden, during this period, we haven't just expanded the population, we've turned into a superpower militarily. Our economy, Baruch Hashem, has become, thank God, has braced us against the COVID. We're exporting life, prosperity, medical technology, agrotechnology to the entire world. The entire country is blooming in a way that it resisted for thousands of years. Torah is flourishing, not just in Israel. Torah is flourishing across the world because of Israel. Any Jew is learning in Lakewood today. It's because we have the state of Israel and we have Jewish pride back. And when Jews have pride, they invest in infrastructure and Torah and community. And if not for the state, and how many Jews today would be lost to history without the state of Israel? How many Jews that aren't learning in Lakewood, their only connection, their Twitter feed, their Twitter likes is because something about this country draws them. And as strange as it sounds to you, it's going to sound like an ironic statement, we have a strong democracy. And that's going to sound really strange because what do you mean if you have elections every couple months? The strongest democracy is a democracy that functions on its own without politicians. That's a little bit difficult. You need politicians to make decisions. But essentially, the fact that we've been able to keep the country afloat during the pandemic without leadership shows that we have a solid social contract. We have a society that works together. Obviously, you need people to make decisions, and there'll be situations that will fail, like budgeting. But the country's not falling apart, like other third world countries will fall apart without leadership. It's not easy to build a democracy in this part of the world. It should be obvious to you, not just because there's no democracy in the Middle East, but because we're obsessed with security, as we have to be, and security and rights oftentimes clash. You have to give up your rights for security. And how do you create that balance between rights and democracy and security? This is not the work of the Satan. This is not just some fake out. Faked you out, change the world. You know what the Satan does? Satan makes you a little tired in the morning so you don't come to Shacharis. That's what the Satan can do. You know what the Satan does? The Satan makes you have a little bit of a desire just to test your Bechira Chavshis. That power Hashem gave the Satan. Hashem doesn't give the Satan the power to change all of history in 70 years and turn this nation into a superpower and have Jews come from all corners of the earth just to say, you know what, faked you out. You fell for it. You fell for the Zionist plan. You fell for it. And that was Manoach's wife teaching him, Hashem won't be toying with us. If he toys with us, it's to give us a little bit of a Yetzirah. Hashem doesn't perform all these miracles, all these revelations to toy with us. And then there's another person in this yeshiva, because this is the Rosh Yeshiva slot a day early. Rav Lichtenstein's Zionism was very, very, very grounded. He rarely, if ever, spoke about prophecy. He rarely, if ever, took sections of Tanakh and tried to derive meaning from those sections to help us process the trajectory of the state of Israel. You know what this first hit me? 23 years ago. Well, you can do the math. What happened 23 years ago? 50th anniversary. That was a biggie. 50th anniversary of the state of Israel. Wow, that was a really big celebration. In fact, I remember some people came from America to join us for Yom HaTzmaut, and they traveled all the way. And on their way back to the airport, they said, boy, that was a real dud. We came for fireworks. We came for Epiphany. We came for supernatural events. And what did you do? You made a mangal. You walked around. My kids were little. You walked on a little tiol, and you came home and daven mincha. Well, part of redemption is just living natural, normal lives in our country. It doesn't have to be spectacular. It doesn't have to be otherworldly. It doesn't have to be. Rav Amital again would always quote Zechariah, source number 6, Karamar Hashem, Tzevekos, Od Yeshvu, Zekenim, Zekenos, Berchovos, Yushalayim. This is the great apocalypse of Zechariah. The men and women will stroll through Yushalayim with canes because they'll be old enough to need canes and they won't be beheaded or murdered when they're younger. The streets of Yushalayim, source 6, will be filled with children. What's so apocalyptic about these scenes? Travel to Norway, they happen every day. Travel to California, they happen every day. Travel to Sydney, they happen every day. Children walk through the streets, and old people stroll through long summer afternoons. But what's normal and natural and pastoral for every single country is apocalyptic for the Jewish people, because we never had this. Because we weren't zochet to this. And you know what? We're still not zochet to this, because kids can't walk freely in Netivot and Ofakim and Kiryat Shmona. Still. when the rockets are shelling. And of course, Ashdod and Ashkelon, and obviously, Chas HaShalom, rockets, of course, not going to hit every part of our country. So we still have that in the back of our heads. So we're still struggling for this apocalyptic achievement of normalcy, because we're not a normal nation, because we hover above history, because we're not part of history, because we challenge history. So Rav Avital was always pushing us, reading Tanakh, reading Rambam's, the 50th year celebration of our state of Israel. What did Rav Aaron speak about? What prophecy did he quote for us? He talked about Yovel. And he gave at the Mesiba a 2-hour shiur about Dine Yovel. And he tried to use the halachos of Yovel to help us understand how we should approach the state. For Rav Aaron was very, very grounded. The state of Israel is a place for the Jews to take refuge, a place for them to perform mitzvahs, a place for them to learn Torah, a place for them to live a holistic Jewish experience rather than, as you live in Chutz La'aretz, Jewish archipelagos and a sea of Gentile experiences. Here, everything is Jewish, as you'll see tomorrow. And let me end by reading these two stories that happened about 50 years apart. Two different people. They couldn't be more different, with Rav Aaron starring in both these scenes. I will hear something incredibly common about Rav Lichtenstein. Second page. Rav Lichtenstein visits Israel in 1962. And who else is there in 1962? Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Rebbe, Rav Huttner, from Slobodka, from Chaim Berlin. I myself underwent this experience. One day, I went to see Mari Varabi Rav Huttner. He had an attachment to Israel. He had studied in Hebron when he was still in Hebron. The Slobodka Yeshiva had moved to Hebron. He began to ask me, what are my impressions? What do I feel? So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says, I discussed the vitality of Jewish life, the sense of total community as opposed to the diaspora where one's life is fragmented. Rav Huttner said, you could have had that vitality and wholeness in Eastern Europe. Don't tell me about vitality and wholeness. You could have had that in the Shtetl. Okay, Rav Aaron tries again. Then I said, I think there's a broader range of application of halacha in Israel, not just vitality and holistic Jewish experience, but halacha, Shemitah, Yovel, Trumos, and Maestros. He said, yeah, you could have seen that in Eastern Europe and Northern Africa. People will keep halacha intensely. I tried to get him to elaborate, but finally Rav Huttner exclaimed, I'm reading, Rav Huttner tells Rav Aaron, why don't you mention the uniqueness of being in Eretz Yisrael? Chazal speak of Eretz Yisrael as a country that Moshe and Aaron didn't merit to enter, and we are there. It was stunning to Rav Huttner to meet a Ben Torah on an airplane flying to Israel whose attitude was the same as if we were going to California. Rav Lichtenstein used to tell us that he would recite Tehillim every time he landed in Israel. Every time he landed, he would say a parak of Tehillim. Not to lose the vitality of that. Because it becomes just routine. You go, you come, you land, you fly, you get your belongings together, you move off the plane, you're home. Landing in Israel, Moshe and Aaron looked at this land. He couldn't even step where we dance tonight. And Rav Aaron was just answering Israel more halacha, more vitality, more batei din. And he said, what about the uniqueness? He didn't speak about redemption. What about the uniqueness? So Rav Aaron says, those of you who have a piece of paper, look at the piece of paper. I walked out of there like a beaten dog. This thought, this feeling is what I want to share with you. So Rav Aaron talked about how in 1962, he was grounding it in halacha, in more Jews, in a refuge. He's being very conservative. Rav Aaron's very conservative. A friend was saying, why don't you think about something larger? Okay, now fast forward to about 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, Rav Sabato. Anyone know who Rav Sabato is? Chaim Sabato, the Rosh Hashiva Malei Adumim. Only one phrase I can use to describe him. Giant amongst men. Giant amongst men. And I've met giants. I know how to tell a giant. He's one of the few people in this world that I would pay money just to sit with and talk. Giant amongst men. And you look at him and he looks like a taxi driver. That's what makes him a giant amongst men. You don't have to hold yourself anyway. You don't have to have posture. You're to yourself. You don't need to show off. Giant amongst men. So he interviewed Rav Lichtenstein in a book called Mevakshei Panecha, Seeking His Presence. If you're not able to read Rav Lichtenstein's panoramic, labyrinthine lectures like 99% of the people in the world, this is a great sefer to read. These are not short interviews, but these are pointed questions that Rav Aaron answers. It's Rav Sabato interviewing Rav Aaron, Seeking His Presence, Mevakshei Panecha. So Rav Sabato asked Rav Buchenstein, well, you talked about Israel, you talked about seizing the staff of Israel, you talked about the risks of the nation of Israel. It is clear, though, beyond everything you see, a refuge, a state, people to live as Jews. Second paragraph, Rav Kook's students see the establishment of the independent Israel as much more than a diplomatic arrangement. They see it as a historical event. Like I just said, Rav Amital. And your teacher, your mentor, Rav Soloveitchik, wrote about this in his essay, Kol Dodi Dofek, right? Those of you, the Rav wrote this beautiful essay called Kol Dodi Dofek about Hashem knocking on the door of history. So, thus far, on the last page, Rav Sabato interviews Rav Aaron. He hasn't mentioned anything of this type. Rav Aaron says, listen to this line. Throw away. And I don't know to what degree Kol Dodi Dofek reflects the Rav's approach to that his whole life. That's not me. And that's what makes the Abbas Yisrael and Abbas Eretz Yisrael so powerful in this room and in this building. It's that duality. We want to taste from the cup of prophecy. We want to feel like we're leading prophetic lives. We want to feel like we can look back to Tanakh and celebrate our current reality. But A, Rav Amital's voice was, don't expect apocalypse. Don't expect a complete overhaul. It can happen slowly. So you guys don't fully appreciate how powerful this message is. If you go back to 1997, 1998, there were people who stopped saying Reshit Tzvichas Gulasenu after Oslo. Now, I'm not concerned whether you do or you don't say it, but if you do say it and then you stop saying it, it means in your mind, any retreat means redemption is ended. Or people who stopped feeling that this is redemptive after 2005, after the disengagement from Oslo. And Rav Amital's constant message to us was, it can stall, it can lag, it can pause, it can reverse, it's not going to be perfect, it's a stage, it's not going to be heavenly clouds with Moshe and Aaron landing with the Beis HaMikdash in their hands. And second of all, to appreciate what Israel has given us, even before we reach those redemptive stages, the fact that we have the chance to study Torah, the fact that this was Rav Aaron's message, that we can live with other Jews, that we can create holistic societies, that we can just life even. Let's say, for example, this weren't part of a larger prophetic process. Would we not be happy that we're sitting here in Gush Etzion, in a Jewish state, with our family, with our police force, studying Torah, building our land, raising our families, stretching halacha? Let's say redemption weren't part of history. A lot of cultures and religions don't understand redemption. We have redemption as the end point, the terminus of history, and we know that we're in that terminus. That's what creates solid Abbas Yisrael, and has nothing to do with what kippah you have, and nothing to do with what flag you wave. It just means that when you get to Shemayim, you answer Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know what? That was part of my religious mind. That was part of my religious consciousness. I thought about what place in history I was born into. I thought about what's happening around me. And I try to fuse it to my religion. Fuse it. Try to fuse it. It shouldn't be your ideology. And that's what's so hard. In Chutz La'aretz, it's very hard. And a lot of yeshivas, I don't know the yeshivas in South Africa as much, but if I had one executive prerogative, if I were made principal of all American high schools for a day, and I can make one change, well, it's hard to decide what the most important change would be. Probably eliminating valedictorian or head boy. I think that's horrendous. It's insulting. It's deceitful to the boy who wins it because you think that brains are important in life. Sets you up for failure. Hurts other people's feelings. No, why there needs to be in Israel, there's no such thing. Do we have a head boy here? They actually call it head boy in South Africa. No, don't worry. Don't be embarrassed. But hopefully you'll succeed in life and it won't have anything to do with you. There's still hope for you. But my real change would be, because you come in, and what's Limudei Kodesh? Gemara, Halacha, Musar, Davening, more Gemara, Tanakh, maybe Chumash Tanakh.
Is that just Gemara?
And then in the afternoon, Mrs. Greenberg comes in and teaches you about Israel. Shouldn't the discussion about Israel be part of Limudei Kodesh? Shouldn't all this be part of your firm guide? What I just described right now, is this my ideology? No. Is this my politics? No. Am I wearing a kippah sugah? No. it's part of my neshama. It's part of my avodas Hashem, as best as it can be. And I'd be half a yid without it. And it's just like reading a page of Gemara to me. And that's the message you don't pick up on Chutzlarts, even if you learn about Zionism in Israel, because it's so compartmentalized. And this is your chance in yeshiva to live through Yom Ha'atzmaut as part of being a yeshiva bachar, as part of davening in the place you daven every day, part of your avodas Hashem. Now be an Oved Hashem by celebrating our people. And we're not going to learn tomorrow that much, but celebrate the land, be with the yeshiva, walk in your tealim, have a mangal. Obviously, we'll say halal, we'll have shirim. But there's a chance to bottle this spirit, fuse it to religious identity, so that every year, from here onwards, no matter where you are, when Yom HaTzmaut comes, and sadly, in many of your communities, those who trend towards more of a firm posture probably don't celebrate Yom HaTzmaut. Those who do celebrate Yom HaTzmaut tend to be less... So they're not really fusing it to their religious identity. It's like very, very polarized. But can you be that person for whom saying Hallel tomorrow is not Chas V'Shalom a political statement and not Chas V'Shalom a break of Sfira? It is the biggest mitzvah you can imagine. I cannot imagine myself not waking up tomorrow and saying Hodu L'Adonai Ki Tov Ki L'Olam Chasdo. With everything my eyes have seen, and everything I've lived through, and everything I've experienced, I cannot imagine not saying that tomorrow to the Ribono Shel Olam. That would make me, to me, that's the firmest thing I can imagine doing tomorrow. And that should be, hopefully, the voice that leads you towards that avodas Hashem. Okay, so we'll stop here, guys. Chag Sameach to everyone. And the minhag is to wear white shirts.